You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When the financial markets went into free fall in late 2008, few people, if anyone, understood what exactly was happening. In the wake of the crisis, we began to piece together how the worst economic meltdown in post-war America had been caused to some degree by irresponsible banks and mortgage companies. While many aspects of the crisis are better understood today, others, like the goals and outcomes of governmental intervention, are still largely unclear. Economist Alan S. Blinder takes a comprehensive look at what happened and what has been done in the years since in his latest book called After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and the Work Ahead. Mr. Blinder is a professor of economics at Princeton University. He was a member of President Clinton's original Council of Economic Advisors and then served as vice chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. His book is published by Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Much has been written about the financial crisis. What do you bring to the story that's new?
Well, I try to bring a couple of things. I mean, nothing is really, really new. But the question is, what in the world happened to us in a kind of a holistic way? Many, many people have written about various and sundry parts, and some of this writing is quite good, actually. But I tried to put the whole thing together into a coherent whole, both how we got into the mess, then what the government did on an emergency basis to make sure the ship didn't sink, and then what the government has done and is doing. This is a continuing saga to try to improve the financial system, prop up the economy, and so on.
What are the most important aspects of the financial crisis and its aftermath for the American people to understand now?
I think,
because there just seemed to be so much disparate information.
Yes, and there's an awful lot. I think, just to hit a few things, people have to keep aware of risk. There was this belief that took hold during the lead up to the crisis that, first of all, you couldn't lose money in real estate. Now, how could they have believed that? People have lost money in real estate, but many people came to realize that. As a consequence, and here is the second thing people need to remember, people borrowed irresponsible sums in order to buy real estate. There were loans being given, mortgage loans, with zero down. Zero. That means you're not really an owner. You're a renter who's praying that the house will go up in value, and in many cases, those prayers were not answered. The flip side of that, of course, to remember, is there were banks willing to give those crazy loans to people. They never should have done it. And finally, well, not finally, there are many, but last that I'll mention, there were regulators that had authority to stop these irresponsible practices and didn't.
Well, we've had other bubbles in the past. Do you think that knowing these things will have much of an impact on how we and our political leaders will act in the future?
Only a little, I'm afraid to say. Now, should it happen quickly? For example, if you went back in time 8 months, there was a lot of fear that we were going to have, quote, Lehman II because of the Eurozone imploding. We're not worried about that anymore. That's sort of been taken care of, or at least pushed back. Had it happened that quickly again, I think people still remember. But as time goes by and as lending looks safer and as we don't have any implosions, people will start forgetting.
Had it become clear to most economists that there was a housing bubble before it burst, did you see it coming?
I did see it coming, but first of all, not with the virulence that it hit. And secondly, not in time. So you didn't put a time date on that. If you ask me, did many economists see this coming in the year 2002? The answer is no. There were a few.
And they were warned us, and yep, they were pretty much ignored.
They were pretty much ignored. And frankly, they were a minority group in 2002. By the time you got to 2006, it was a majority group. But then it was too late. The bubble had blown up to such an extent that it was going to burst nastily.
You date the start of the recession to a precise date.
I do.
September 15th, 2008. Why that day?
Well, I should say the National Bureau of Economic Research is the official arbiter of these things, and it doesn't agree. It dated it earlier. I'll tell you why. That is the date that Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy. Right up until that happened, things looked somewhat dicey, not fabulous. The economy was barely growing. But it didn't really look like we were going to have a recession, or it wasn't clear we were going to have a recession, and there certainly was no indication we were going to have the worst recession since the 1930s. When Lehman went to bankruptcy court and things started falling apart at the seams, my personal attitude, and I was not the only one, about the economy went from, oh, this doesn't look so good, to, oh, God, this looks horrible. That's why I date it exactly to that day.
And how long before we hit bottom?
And the good news, so to speak, and this has something to do with the government policy response, the good news is we bottomed out sort of in March or so of 2009. That's only 6 months later. And now the economy then started growing again around June, July of 2009. So that's only 9 months later. While we were sliding downhill, there were many people saying, this is going to be like a two-year slide. This is going to look like the 1930s. Thank goodness that did not happen.
Why did the government choose to save Bear Stearns but not Lehman Brothers?
Boy, I wish I knew the answer to that question. This is one of the mysteries. I think we can chip away at the answer.
Because Bear Stearns was too big to fail. That was the reason given. But Lehman Brothers was bigger, wasn't it?
Lehman Brothers was almost twice the size of Bear Stearns. I'll give you a few pieces of the rationale. With the proviso, I think to your question, the inconsistency between those two treatments was wrong and very damaging. So what were some of the things said? First, that even though Lehman was twice the size of Bear, it wasn't as connected with other entities in the country and around the world as Bear Stearns was. I don't think that was right. Secondly, Hank Paulson, you may recall, said at that time, we can't keep bailing out companies. They're calling me Mr. Bailout. So he was worried about his own reputation, but about this concept of moral hazard, that if you let bankers and financiers in general, those were not actually banks, those are investment banks. If you let them know they're going to be bailed out no matter what, they're going to behave badly. So, I mean, there was a truth to that.
Well, there are others who argue that we should have allowed more to fail.
I think a better argument than the side we should have drawn the line at Lehman and let them fail is that we should have drawn the line at Bear. I think history is going to argue that one out for a long time because it was the inconsistency in those two treatments that confused a lot of people.
Well, what does Section 13.3 of the Federal Reserve Act state?
Section 13.3, which like seven people on Earth knew about before the crisis, was used many, many times by the Fed. What it said before Dodd-Frank, which changed it, is that in an emergency, I think the phrase is unusual and exigent circumstances. So an emergency, the Federal Reserve can basically lend to anyone. When I was on the Fed, I used to tell people, you know, we could lend money to my brother-in-law if it was in the national interest. Anyone, any person, any business, anybody. That was used in the case of Bear Stearns and in a variety of others, in the case of AIG, and the Fed leaned on 13.3. Very hard. The wings of 13.3 got clipped a bit by Congress in the Dodd-Frank Act.
What happened in the markets between when the Fed saved Bear Stearns in the spring of 2008 and Lehman's failure in September, when most would say, the bottom fell out of the market?
You know, there was a kind of an eerie calm in the market. Nothing horrible happened, except, well, there was Fannie and Freddie. That came before. That was a very special case. But in the purely private sector, nothing much happened. There was a lot of rumblings going on, a lot of concern, and by the way, a lot of talk that Lehman would be next. This was not that big a surprise.
There was a lot of talk about the moral hazard because after Lehman was allowed to fail, the U.S. bailed out other banks and automakers. Will banks make risky decisions knowing that the government considers them too vital to the economy to fail?
We hope not. First of all, in the near term, the memory lingers on. And even though you got saved, if you did get saved, the salvation wasn't very pleasant for the managers and the owners of these institutions. And that'll be remembered for a while and then forgotten like most things. The enduring thing is the provisions in the Dodd-Frank Act that basically turn the too-big-to-fail doctrine into too-big-to-fail suddenly and messily, but you will fail. It is no longer legal to keep these dying entities alive. The government takes the control panel, so to speak, and eases them to a hopefully quiet death. That's what the Dodd-Frank Act provides for.
My guest is Alanis Blinder. His latest book, After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, birthday response and the work ahead. Other people, the government got involved with a whole slew of people, AIG, Goldman Sachs.
Yes.
But it's my sense that Dodd-Frank, you're talking about it as though this is important legislation, that much of it isn't being implemented and it's largely being overlooked.
It's very important legislation. I don't know that it's being overlooked, but it's certainly for the most part not implemented yet. People often don't realize that the regulatory wheels in the United States grind slowly, and for good reasons. You don't want these things flying off to excess. But Congress passes laws that tend to be skeletal. Even the Dodd-Frank at great length was skeletal. And the details need to be filled in by regulation writers at the agencies. And as that's going on, interested parties, or anybody, though it's mainly the interested parties that do it, get to comment and suggest, you know, don't do that, do this instead. That can take a long time, and it is taking a long time. And not incidentally, the industry is fighting back with every lobbyist they have.
Now, why are they fighting back? Weren't they hurt by the crisis?
They were hurt.
By the meltdown?
But yes, they absolutely were. They're not against getting government aid. What they're fighting back against is restrictions on their behavior that will reduce their profitability.
Well, you write an op-ed column for the Wall Street Journal.
Right.
Do they cut right to you to complain about what you've written?
Oh, yes. The Wall Street Journal audience is not like your audience. When I want to amuse myself or get depressed, it's almost the same, I go to the blog and see what Wall Street Journal writers are writing to me about. And mostly it's about me. Some of it can't be read on air.
So there isn't that kind of collegial spirit that you would expect.
You know, there is with some people. I must say the editorial department of the Wall Street Journal is very easy to work with, fabulously. They don't try to stifle what I have to say in any way, not even the slightest.
You describe how the crisis created a jobs deficit. What's the deficit today?
Oh, we still have, I can't give you the exact right number, but I would think we're in the sort of 6 million job range, in, you know, plus or minus, that you get the deficit by sort of adding up the number of jobs that were lost and the number of jobs that should have been created given the time that had elapsed from then to now. At peak, that number was like 11 million-ish.
Well, then, of course, there are different definitions of joblessness, whether you just lost a job and were looking for one, whether you've given up, right, whether something else has happened. But some are suggesting that this current situation is the new normal.
I don't buy that for a minute. There are a few advantages of growing old, but one of them is you have a little history in your head. And I well remember that the 1973-75 recession was called the Great Recession. Then the 1981-2 recession was called the Great Recession. Now this one is called the Great Recession.
Except Paul Krugman is calling it a depression.
A depression. I don't buy that terminology. When the peak unemployment rate was 10%, which is horrible, but nothing like a depression. In each of those prior cases, many, many allegedly thoughtful voices said, we'll never get the unemployment rate back down to 6 again. We may not reach 7 again. And once we got the economy's engine revved, instead the unemployment rate went down to 5% or even 4%.
Well, the U.S. economy shrank 0.1% at an annualized rate in the fourth quarter of 2012.
Yes.
It was the first contraction in 3 years. 0.1% doesn't sound like a large number to me. How concerned should we be?
No, not very. Well, let me give you two answers to that. Not very over that number. That number was a fluke. First of all, 0.1%, nobody measures it that right. It's zero, basically. It was caused mainly by the reversal of some flukish things that happened in the third quarter and made the GDP grow faster that reversed themselves, as seemed inevitable, in the fourth quarter. One had to do with inventories. One had to do with federal spending, especially defense spending. But the second part of the answer, which is more important, is we should be concerned that this economy is not growing fast enough.
My guest is Alan S. Blinder. His latest book, After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and The Work Ahead. It is published by the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Alan S. Blinder, the Gordon S. Rentschler Memorial Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton University, Vice Chairman of the Promontory Interfinancial Network, which is a financial service firm based in Arlington, Virginia. He also served as the Vice Chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors from 1994 to 1996, was a member of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors, and he writes a regular monthly op-ed column for the Wall Street Journal. His latest book is After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and The Work Ahead. It's published by Penguin Press. You place blame for the crisis on what you call the Malevolent Seven. Who are they?
Well, we won't have time to do all of them, but let's start. First of all, we talked about this earlier, people, Americans. Some things were happening in other countries too, but Americans that were deluded by the housing boom, caught up in the euphoria, and got themselves into contracts that made no sense.
Was that their fault or the fault of the people who were selling them these things?
Right. Second is the people who were selling them these things, who in some cases were caught up in the same crazy euphoria, like every mortgage will be good and nothing will default. But in some cases were predators, in fact. This was more the non-banks than the banks, the mortgage brokers rather than the banks, that were talking these people, some of whom were barely literate and certainly none of whom were financially sophisticated, into mortgages they shouldn't have been in.
We've heard stories of bankers like Fabrice Touré, who wrote cavalier emails about the banking practices that led to the crisis. He was called Fabulous Fab before things went bad.
By himself. By himself. Most of the rest of us didn't think him fabulous. This is a personification of the third villain, which is the so-called securitizers, a lousy word. But what does that mean? It means companies, Wall Street companies mostly, but some others, that packaged a whole bunch of mortgages into securities and then created a crazy quilt of derivatives on top of those basic securities. This is what the Fabulous Fab, by his own evaluation, was doing. And he was preying, in his own words, on widows and orphans in Belgium. I don't know why he wanted to do that.
Has he ever been prosecuted?
My understanding is there's not been a prosecution. He was suspended from his job. I don't think he was ever, as far as I know, he was not convicted of anything.
And in this country, of course, there are many people who are wondering why there have been no prosecutions. It was even a frontline investigation. And
yes.
The Department of Justice man seemed to suggest that he wasn't thinking so much about criminal acts as to whether it was going to have an impact on financial institutions, which doesn't seem to me to be the role of a prosecutor. That was Lanny Brewer.
Yes, it was Lanny Brewer. I agree. Look, one of the things I take up in this book, among many others, is exactly this question. How come we didn't prosecute anybody? Can it really be true that even though in the S&L crisis, which was much less severe of the late 80s and early 90s, 700, 800, 900 people went to jail for fraud.
Enron people went to jail.
And in Enron, people went to jail. And in this case, there were a few people in jail, a handful, three, five. Can that be all there was? I mean, I think, by the way, this is part of the American public's distaste with the whole operation. How come the crooks didn't go to jail?
What about the ratings agencies? How culpable were they?
They were culpable, not crooked. I mean, there was nothing fraudulent or anything.
But they
obviously like
overlooked things and sometimes allowed themselves to be pressured into looking the other way.
A little less pressured, but something subtly different, but amounts to the same thing, which is regulator shopping. We have a system, and we still have it. It needs to be changed, where the rating agencies, get paid by the issuers of the securities. As if my students were paying me for their grades. The dean would not allow that. But the dean of the financial markets, whoever he or they are, do allow that. And what you would get is a system where companies would say, you know, if I went to rater A, I might only get a single A rating. Let's talk to regulator B, and maybe I can get a triple A. rating, and things like that went on, and they slapped the AAA on many too many securities.
Some of which just fell apart.
Many of which fell apart.
How would you rate the Federal Reserve's response to the crisis?
Well, I would
used to work for it.
Oh, I did. I give the Federal Reserve two different grades, if you'll permit me. One before the crisis, where their grade is low, and one after the crisis, where their grade is very high. Leading up to the crisis, the Federal Reserve, like the other bank regulatory agencies, was regulation light, way too light. It had authority to clamp down on these lending practices. It didn't use that authority.
Was it paying much attention to it?
Not enough. It was paying enough attention.
I mean, were they aware of
they
just
were.
How dangerous the whole thing was?
Well, I think nobody was aware of quite how dangerous it was. But they were well aware that there were irresponsible banking practices going on, and they didn't crack down on it.
How can you not see something like telling someone you don't have to have a job, you don't have to have the possibility of a job, but I'm going to sell you this house?
Right.
How can you see there's anything other than dangerous?
You're alluding to the ninja loans, no income, no job, no assets. I believe the answer to that is I don't know every ninja loan, obviously. Nobody does. There shouldn't have been any of them. But many, many more of those came from non-banks than from banks. The banks were guilty. The non-banks in the business competing with the banks were much more guilty.
How does the Federal Reserve's response compare to the European Central Bank's response?
Once the crisis hit, I think it was vastly superior that the Federal Reserve put the ECB, the European Central Bank, to shame in the speed and volume of its reactions. The ECB is catching up now. Very strongly, but was very slow off the mark.
But the European response seemed to be to impose austerity.
That was not the central banks, but the governments, the fiscal authorities, reacted in many countries with austerity. England is a very prominent example, and they're now looking at what people are potentially calling a triple dip recession. And other European countries are also suffering from austerity. Much more than we.
Well, austerity obviously has caused problems. Why then do so many American lawmakers insist on austerity as the solution to our problem?
Man, I wish I knew the answer to that. I teach elementary economics at Princeton. Thousands of others teach elementary economics all over the place. And it does not teach that when your economy is growing too slow, what you need is fiscal austerity. Believe me, we teach the opposite.
But you're teaching Keynesian economics,
there
are many
economics.
People who despise Keynes,
yep.
who argue that Ayn Rand has a much better grasp of economic theory.
Yes, well, I think they're quite wrong. I think Keynes had a lot better grasp of it than Ayn Rand ever did.
My guest is Alan S. Blinder. His latest book, After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and The Work Ahead, published by Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's talk a bit about the Troubled Asset Relief Program, known as TARP. You say that the banks were told by Hank Paulson, President Bush's Secretary of Treasury, that they must take the money. Why?
Yeah, these are the big banks. Mm-hmm. There was a famous meeting at the Treasury on Columbus, the day after Columbus Day in 2008, and they were basically forced to take the money. Now, some of them wanted the money.
You know, some of them took it reluctantly?
Some of them took it
Didn't they need it?
No. Some needed it. So a prominent example is Citibank, which knew they needed it, and they grabbed it and said thank you. Other banks like Goldman Sachs, you mentioned before, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo from California, didn't need the money. They had enough capital. They were not worried about it. They really didn't want it. Why did Paulson force it down their throats? I think it was bad thinking, but this was his thinking, that he wanted to make sure that the federal money, the government's money, was not stigmatized. It was not a signal that this is a terrible bank and you better run from the bank and sell the stock and so on. So he forced the cream of the crop. Now, none of them were that great then, but these were the cream of the crop to take money in addition to the troubled banks.
And what happened to that money? Did they just give it back as soon as they could?
They gave it back as soon as they could. That's exactly right.
And have the ones that were troubled, also paid back the money?
Most of them. All the big ones have paid back.
So has the United States turned a profit from TARP?
Oh, absolutely. A sizable profit.
Despite the fact that it was so controversial at the time?
It, controversial is putting it mildly. As you remember, it failed in the House of Representatives the first time and then passed after that. It was more than controversial. It was vilified. It still is. People don't understand that.
Well, is that partly the government's fault for not explaining things well?
I think it is. Now, partly. You used exactly the right adverb. If you were the greatest explainer in the world and did it 150 times, a bank bailout is still going to be unpopular. No bank bailout has ever been popular in the history of the universe. But there are degrees of unpopularity, and I think if the government had done a better job of explaining, at least explaining that it's now turned a profit, very few Americans know that, people would think a bit better of it than they did. They wouldn't love it for sure.
So, I mean, what would the government do? Would the president give a speech in which he said, people misunderstand what happened with TARP. This has been a great success.
I think probably
we're very proud.
Sort of. I think by the time you get down to the level of detail of the TARP as opposed to a bigger picture, you're probably talking about the Secretary of the Treasury rather as spokesman for the president.
The new Secretary of the Treasury.
Well, it would have been the old one and now the new one. It's a little late for the new one coming in 2013 when TARP is pretty much over, although it still does get in the news now and then.
It still has a bad reputation.
It still has a bad reputation, so I think there's still communications work to do. I try to do some of it in this book.
Many people have been confused as to why the government didn't do more to help the homeowners who had been victims of the predatory behavior by mortgage companies. Why did the government focus on the banks and not the homeowners?
Well, it's a really good question. I'm, in fact, one of the people that have been at the top of the hill screaming about this since the year 2008. So I'm a bit baffled. I'll tell you what I think is the reason. It comes in several parts. First, it's a big bill. There were a lot of bad mortgages, and to do something of the nature that we should have, something that would slightly resemble what Franklin Roosevelt did in the 1930s, you were probably talking about $200, $300, $400 billion. Now, not spending, lending, and most of that will come back. I don't think it would have cost the government a nickel in the end, but laying it out, borrowing in order to do the spending. Secondly, I think there was a misread of the politics. Many politicians took the incorrect lesson, according to the polling, that Americans were against this. Yes, they were against the banks getting money, but they were also against their neighbor who was irresponsible getting money.
And many of our callers have been asking, who's more responsible in a mortgage transaction? The person who takes the money knowing that there's a good chance he's never going to be able to pay it back? Or the person who gives it to him saying, don't worry?
You know, in that instance, I guess I'd call it a flat-footed tie. I'd like to wrap both of them over the knuckles. There were many other mortgages, however, that the mortgagee didn't really understand what they were getting themselves into. In that case, I think it's very clear that the blame goes on the lender.
Another listener, Tom in California, asks if you think that the major banks should be broken up, and he wonders why they haven't been.
I wouldn't be so quick to do that. Let's go back a little in history.
But wait, but the banks were much more limited in their scope before Glass-Steagall was repealed.
Not so much. People don't realize that. Glass-Steagall had become a shell by the time it was repealed in 1990. Banks were allowed by regulation and financial innovation to do most of the things that Glass-Steagall in the 30s thought they were getting rid of. There was still a little bit, so it did matter. But the repeal of Glass-Steagall was not a first-order event in this saga.
Although many people do seem to think it was.
Many people.
You said that Congress rewrote the rule book of finance in 2010, yeah. Yet many have claimed that little has been done to prevent another crisis. What has been done?
I think a fair amount has been done. So, for example, you have now what's called in the wonkish jargon orderly liquidation procedure. What in the world does that mean? That means that the next time an institution like Lehman Brothers comes down, or Bear Stearns, or AIG comes down the pike and it looks like it may fall and threaten the whole economy, the federal government now has the legal authority to come in and take it over and liquidate it slowly. Remember I said before, the fear is failing messily and chaotically. We don't want that. We want to put these institutions to bed peacefully.
Now, we have very little time, but I want to touch on the Recovery Act. the so-called stimulus package. Right. Do you consider the national debt increase that came with the stimulus to be justifiable?
I do. Now, it's an unfortunate side effect, but you can't spend more and tax less without raising the deficit.
But some people are so alarmed by the national debt level.
Yeah. I think there's much too much alarm about that. Not that I wouldn't like it to be smaller if I had a magic wand, but unlike the large increase of the deficit under the Bush administration, that's Bush 2, George W. Bush, which was done for no good reason, the increases in the deficit in the first Obama administration, we're just starting the second, in the first Obama administration, were done for very good reasons. It was propping up the economy, which might have had a much harder fall.
One of the reasons being given for the shrinkage of the U.S. economy is that there hasn't been enough stimulus in Europe, and so Europeans aren't buying American-made products.
I think that's true, but easy to exaggerate. The world is very globalized. Despite that, 85% of what Americans buy and use, services, goods, is made in America. Only the other 15% relies on foreign demand, and Europe's only a fraction of that. So I think it's almost always a mistake to blame any weakness in the U.S. economy on anyone else but ourselves.
In the past, when the dollar was weak, we were supposed to be able to improve export.
Right.
It didn't work.
No, we did, actually. If you look at it, when the dollar was weak, we did improve our exports. Yeah, it did work.
Where's the dollar now?
You know, high low is in the eye of the beholder.
I go to Europe for my vacation this summer?
It depends how much you like Europe, but you'll get it cheaper in the United States. I can assure you of that.
Alan S. Blinder, his latest book from Penguin Press called After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and The Work Ahead. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, thank you for having me.